When we reached Dunfinan, she leaned forward and pointed the driver in the right direction.
I don't have any cash on me.
I'll take care of it, Aisling said. I unclipped the seatbelt, pausing before I got out of the car.
Are you mad at me?
I said. Just get some sleep. I'll talk to you tomorrow. I waited until the taxi disappeared before I turned towards the house. I crept upstairs, trying to be as quiet as I could, because I was afraid of waking my father. If I woke him, maybe I would ask him why he had married my mother if he was going to spend most of his time nursing a pint in Donny's pub. I would ask him why we weren't enough for him, even when my mother was alive. Why did it take Mam's death for you to change, Dad? I would ask him if he had ever loved her at all. 19th of August. Matthew. Greetings from Paris. A picture of Edith Piaf's grave. Sarah, oh my God, you went to Père Lachaise. Sarah, I can't believe you remembered. I'm so touched. Sarah, you should go to Derrières for lunch if you're near the 3rd and 4th arrondissement. Get the floating island for dessert. It's insane. Sarah, and go to the Musée d'Art Moderne. Everyone goes to the Louvre. It's passé. 20th of August. Matthew, at the Louvre. This place is amazing. Sarah, oh, cool. Hope you're having fun. Sarah, what have you planned for the rest of the day? Do you think you'll have a chance to go to the Musée d'Art Moderne? Matthew, I'm heading home this evening. Sarah, are you busy this week? I'd love to see you if you have time. Kiss. Sarah, no worries if it doesn't suit. 30th of August. Matthew, apologies for the lack of contact. Sarah, no need to apologize. I've been crazy busy too. Have so much stuff to organize for going back to school. Sarah, can you believe we're back tomorrow? It doesn't seem fair when it's still August. Sarah, is Harry looking forward to going back? Matthew, good news. I am off child duty on Sunday and half the afternoon free if you would like to catch up. Sarah, I'd love that. What do you want to do? I read a review of this new restaurant in Killiney called Pecan. It sounds amazing. It might be easier for you than having to schlep all the way across town. Matthew, I don't know if it's safe for me to meet you in public when I haven't seen you in a while. Matthew, room 63 at 2 p.m. 1st of September. Matthew, well, that was spectacular, wasn't it? You do continue to amaze me. Sarah, why, thank you. Right back at you, Brennan. Kiss, kiss. Sarah, let's do it again soon. Sarah, when are you free? 18th of September. Sarah, hey, are you free for a chat? Sarah, it won't take long, sorry. Sarah, sure look it. Just text me when you're free. 24th of September. Matthew, sorry, re the lack of contact. I've been up to my teeth with work. Sarah, no worries. I know how busy you are. Matthew, I'll need to see you soon, Sarah. I'm free tomorrow evening. I'll book the room. Now. The weak September light was seeping through the blinds when Sarah woke, tilting the room into a watery grey. She showered, tiptoeing into the spare bedroom where she had left her work outfit, the pencil skirt and floral blouse, the low-heeled court shoes. She stood in front of the mirror when she was ready. She looked neat, she thought. Professional.
Very nice,
Oisin said as he walked into the room, still in his boxer shorts. Did I wake you?
Nah, it's grand.
Oisin put his hands around her waist. He looked unsure, as if asking Sarah for permission to touch her. Sarah wanted to enjoy it. She imagined herself leaning into him and feeling warmth spreading through her, the way it did before. You're all sweaty, Oisin. She pushed him off her. I don't want you to stain my new blouse.
Okay, he said, stepping back. I only came in here to ask if you wanted a lift to work, not to get the head taken off me.
I didn't mean...
I knew I shouldn't have bothered.
I'm sorry, she said. Really, I didn't mean to snap at you. First day back nerves. I'd love a lift. Sarah kissed Oisin when he pulled up outside the convent, wiping lip gloss off his cheek afterwards. That's what good girlfriends did, she thought. They were affectionate. Maybe if she pretended to be a good girlfriend, it might come true. A few of the pupils were standing outside, one making a comment that Sarah couldn't hear through the car window, but which caused the others to dissolve into fits of giggles. Move along, girls, she said, getting out of the car. I'm sure you have classrooms to go to. Let's start this school year as we mean to go on. Yes, Miss Fitzpatrick, they chorused. One of the braver girls, a tall redhead who played with the senior basketball team, asked slyly, Is that your boyfriend, miss? That's none of your business, Ella. Please go to class immediately. They swarmed before her, and she could hear the principals and Donal Wilson and, Oh my God, I love him, floating out of their chatter. Teaching teenage girls was different from what Sarah had expected. The girls could be mercurial, prone to dramatic fights and fallings out, oscillating rapidly between vulnerability and defensiveness, but Sarah was surprised by how much she liked them. She enjoyed their sincerity, how earnest they were in their affection for boy bands and their favorite authors, and the latest child star attempting to throw off the shackles of an early Nickelodeon career. When teenage girls loved something, they loved it fiercely and without shame, unburdened by the same desire to be cool that she had seen in her old school. At St. Finbar's, the boys had wielded their burgeoning masculinity as if it were a weapon. Sarah had started working in this new school last year. She'd wanted a fresh start, someone where no one knew her, so she could reinvent herself. Miss Fitzpatrick, who was always on time for work. Miss Fitzpatrick, who was quiet and kept to herself. She taught her classes efficiently, refusing to feel annoyed by the abject lack of talent as she had at St. Finbar's. Sarah had lost the urge to take the paintbrush off the students and show them what they were doing wrong. She never picked up a paintbrush anymore. Very good, girls, she said at least 50 times a day. That's a very good effort. After work, Sarah walked home alone. The school was only 20 minutes from the house in Booterstown, and it was a typically warm September day. So predictable, Nana Kathleen used to say when Sarah arrived home after her first day back as a teenager, the wool jumper tied around her waist and the shirt sticking to her armpits with sweat. The sun always comes out blazing once the children go back to school. You can set your watch by it. Sarah took her shoes off as soon as she was through the front door, the marble cool beneath her bare feet. In the kitchen, she poured herself a glass of juice and sat at the table, running her fingers across the worn oak with its water rings and grooves, a tapestry of a life well lived. Hi, Dad, she said, answering her phone.
Hi, love. Just wanted to check in about your first day back.
It was grand. Some lively girls in second year. I'll have my work cut out for me as their year head.
You're well able for them, he said. You know, I always thought teaching was a good job for an artist.
Sarah was tired of hearing people say that. The unspoken insinuation that Sarah was lazy for not utilizing her spare time more effectively.
Like William, her dad went on. Sure isn't he the same as yourself?
William is a professor of literature at Trinity College, Dad, Sarah said. It's not quite the same thing, is it? When they hung up, Sarah sat there, reading the comment sections on the Mail Online as she waited for Oisin to come home.
Sarah?
Oisin called out, almost 3 hours later.
I'm in the kitchen.
Hey,
he said, flinging his briefcase on the floor. Do you have to do that?
Do what?
Just throw your stuff all over the place. I'm not sure who you think is going to pick them up, but I'm not your servant, Oisin.
I am very much aware of that,
he said, tucking the briefcase into a corner beside the bookcase. The book that Matthew gave her was still there, on the second shelf. Sarah looked through it occasionally, as if trying to convince herself that her memories were real, that she hadn't simply imagined everything that had happened between them. But the rest belonged to Una. Texts by Judith Butler and Naomi Wolf and Germaine Greer and Susan Faludi, and a history of feminism in Ireland, which featured an essay on Una, and the countrywide protest she had organized after an abortion case involving a teenage rape victim in the 90s.
You should read them,
Una had told Sarah.
You might find them illuminating.
Sarah had tried, eager to ingratiate herself with the great Una McManus in those days. But she gave up midway through an angry polemic about how heterosexual relationships are an archaic form of slavery, and women who accept traditional gender roles in their marriage are complicit in upholding the patriarchal status quo and set a damaging example for their daughters. Was this what rich white women were worried about? Sarah thought of her own mother, washing the kitchen floor and scrubbing the toilets and making the beds and helping Sarah with her homework, and dropping her off at the school gates and cooking pots of potatoes and lamb chops for the farmhands who came in at lunchtime, ravenous, smelling of sweat and manure, their hands raw from over-soaping. And Sarah supposed she could see the validity of the author's argument. In a way, marriage did seem like a form of slavery. Helen's sense of fun, her sense of adventure, had appeared to bleed out with each passing year. She had been trapped in her relationship with Eddie, taking care of Sarah while he was in the pub playing Mr. Popular and buying rounds for his friends. But to call her complicit seemed grossly unfair. What could a woman like Helen do, or Helen's mother before her?
I didn't know your mother's people that well,
Nana Kathleen had told Sarah when she was a teenager and begging for stories about her mother, desperate for any scrap of information she could find.
But the Hayeses were considered notoriously old-fashioned in Dunfinan, even for the 80s.
Sarah's grandfather had declared university a waste of time, especially for girls, and forbade Helen from applying for a grant.
It's a pity, Nana Kathleen said. Your mother was an intelligent woman. She would have done well, I think.
But Helen hadn't been given a choice. Maybe she hadn't even been aware she had one.
How was your first day back?
Oisin asked her. Fine. Sarah's tone was sharp.
You think we don't see, Sarah, how you treat Oisin?
She tried again. Sorry, I'm hungry and cranky. Will we order takeaway?
I'm grand. I took a client out for lunch today. Four-course meal works. I'm stuffed.
Well, what am I supposed to eat?
Order takeaway. I'm not stopping you,
Oisin said.
You can use my card if you want.
I have my own money, thank you very much.
Sarah.
She looked up in surprise. His voice sounded so thin, as if it might crack in half. He was leaning against the kitchen table, his hands by his sides.
What did I do wrong this time?
Nothing, she said. You did nothing wrong, Oisin. I'm sorry. Oisin shuffled into the nook attached to the kitchen, like his feet were too heavy for him. Sarah was left there, searching for the words that would make things better.
Remember, Oisin?
Remember when we moved in here? Their relationship had been relatively new then, only a year old, and people said it was too soon for them to move in together. What was the rush? Sarah didn't know how to explain that she needed Oisin by her side at all times, that she felt as if she couldn't breathe without him. There were so many movies that she didn't know the ending to, books left discarded, TV shows unwatched. Because she was unable to concentrate with Oisin so close to her, she needed to climb onto his lap, to feel him inside her. After she came, Oisin would tell her he loved her.
And when he said that to her, Sarah forgot about Matthew, something she had previously assumed was impossible. And the relief of letting Matthew go was almost unbearably intense. She hadn't realized how heavy the weight of her shame had been, and how tired she had become of carrying it.
"Tell me your secrets,"
Oisin would say as they made a duvet fort and pretended that it wasn't a Wednesday afternoon when they should be out meeting friends or buying groceries or doing normal things like normal people. Maybe they weren't normal, though, Oisin and Sarah. Maybe they were special. Maybe all they needed was each other. "I'll tell you my secrets, if you tell me yours," Sarah had whispered into Oisin's ear, licking it with the very tip of her tongue, feeling him shiver against her. And he did tell her. Oisin told her how much he wanted to please his father, and how he feared that he would never be able to do so. He told her he loved his brother, but he was jealous of Donal, that he wished he had had the bravery to follow his passion and become an actor, instead of fleeing at the first bad audition. He knew it hadn't gone well, Oisin told Sarah. He had forgotten his lines, had asked once, and then twice, if he could start again. He had left the room, but the director's voice was loud, and Oisin had heard what the man said about him.
"Handsome, but stiff as a wooden plank."
Oisin hadn't told anyone else that, he said to Sarah, and she felt oddly triumphant. She wanted to own Oisin in a way no other girlfriend had, particularly Afric Conroy. One night, Sarah had noticed a group of lads staring at them in Stephen's green, one of the men sneering and saying something to his friends that made the rest of them bray with laughter.
"Don't bother,"
Oisin had said when Sarah wanted to confront them.
"It's not worth the hassle. It never is."
Sarah asked Oisin then what it was like to grow up in Ireland as a mixed-race kid.
"Biracial,"
he corrected her, and she apologized, embarrassed. Oisin said that he had never experienced proper racism as a child, the odd slur muttered on the rugby pitch perhaps, but JJ had always sorted that out for him, tackling the culprit to the ground with a devastating blow. It was harder as an adult, Oisin admitted, and he began to understand the degree to which he had been insulated at school, protected by his parents' wealth and his tight-knit circle of friends. He experienced more of it now, he said. Old women clutching at their handbags when he passed them on the street, or the sudden realization that he was always the one person of color at parties. People confused him with Cooper at work, because they were the only two black men in the office, even though Cooper was 10 years older than Oisin and 5 inches shorter. When Kanye and Jay-Z songs were played in clubs, colleagues would sing the N-word, looking at Oisin afterwards, expecting him to laugh, and to reassure them that he didn't mind, that he wasn't too sensitive. He was often told by drunken strangers on nights out that he looked like a certain celebrity, and he knew he didn't, Oisin told Sarah. He didn't look like Obama, or Chris Brown, or Jesse Williams. There were no similarities between them at all, except for the color of their skin. Then there was the time he accidentally knocked against someone on Mary Street and heard, "Fuck off home, will you, black cunt?"
"But that doesn't happen very often,"
Oisin rushed to reassure a furious Sarah.
"It was much harder when Dad moved here in the '70s. He and Mom were practically ostracized in the beginning."
Oisin was lucky in comparison, he told Sarah. "Why didn't your parents stay in London? Wouldn't it have been better there?" she asked him, and Oisin shrugged.
"They wanted to take advantage of the artist's exemption, I think," he said. "And anyway, Dad said the Irish weren't the worst. They got used to him after a while."
Did they get used to William, or used to his growing fame? After he won the Booker, everyone wanted to claim William Wilson as a Paddy, no matter the color of his skin or what nationality his passport said he was. More Irish than the Irish themselves, people said about Oisin and Donal now, with their fluent Irish and traditional names, thanks to their Gaelgeor mother. A credit to their parents, all told.
"So,"
Oisin had said to Sarah,
"now it's your turn."
He asked her what happened when her mother got sick. I was only 9 when she was diagnosed, she told Oisin. 10 when she died.
Too young,
he murmured into her ear.
I'm sorry, babe.
Sarah had told him about the morning she'd woken to find Helen had shaved her hair off, her skull bumpy and misshapen. It was falling out anyway. Thought I might as well do it myself, she had said. Sarah asked her if she was going to wear a wig, and Helen told her she wasn't sure yet, and Sarah had been mortified at the idea of anyone seeing her mother like that. I wish I had asked her how she felt, Sarah said. I wish I wasn't always so selfish. She told Oisin how, initially, Eddie had seemed happy to pretend like the entire thing wasn't happening.
Sure you'll be grand,
he'd said to Helen.
You've always been such a fighter.
But her mother became weaker and weaker until the doctors were talking about making Helen comfortable. Sarah told Oisin how she had wished her mother was dead by the end, just so she could escape that hospital. The antiseptic smell, the wretched people clutching at their family's hands, begging to be allowed to go home one last time. The flat beep of the life support machine, then Helen taking that final, desperate gasp. And it was done. Her mother was dead. Sarah had found it almost exciting. Time off school and so many people in the house. Her mother's corpse in the parlour. People shivering as they touched Helen's yellow hands. There were sandwiches and cake. Sarah was consumed by the insatiable kindness of strangers, wanting to be seen giving her a hug as they told her she was a brave girl. But then it went quiet. The neighbours and the relatives continued with their own lives. The girls in school got bored with her numbing sadness. And she told Oisin about the months when her father didn't speak to her, didn't utter one word from morning until night. Eddie was grieving, she explained, and drinking too much, because he didn't know how to deal with it. Her father had always been a social drinker. His nightly habit of going to the pub in Dunfinan for the one had been the primary cause of the many arguments that Sarah had witnessed as a child. But it had never been like this before. She didn't tell Oisin about the cold house, or how the cupboards were bare for days. No food in the fridge, and nothing for her lunchbox in the morning. She didn't mention how her eyes had begun to look huge as her body shrank. Meetings in the school, and Sarah repeating, I'm fine. She had lost one parent, she couldn't lose the other. And then Nana Kathleen moved in, while Eddie went into hospital, saying prayers with Sarah before bed that the good Lord will help your father find his way again. Her father came back after 2 months.
I'm sorry, Sarah,
he said, hugging her awkwardly. He was more patient with her after that, more present, encouraging her with her artwork, asking her how her day went when she came home from school. He never drank again, but Sarah knew now. She knew how easy it was for things to fall apart, and she couldn't unknow that. Sarah didn't tell Oisin about Matthew either. Some secrets are meant to be kept, in case people use them against you, she thought. Oisin believed she was funny and interesting and confident, and Sarah liked that. She liked how Oisin saw her, and she liked how she felt when she was with him. He made her so happy. He made her forget. Until, one day, he didn't anymore. They moved in together and he left his dishes in the sink and he cracked his knuckles while she was trying to watch TV and he threw his towel on the bed after his shower so the sheets were cold with damp by bedtime. Sarah didn't feel like she had enough space, the space she needed to hide the parts of herself that she was most ashamed of. Her impatience, her tendency to be critical, how quick she was to snap if something annoyed her. Oisin saw all of it, all of her flaws, everything she had tried to suppress for so long, and Sarah hated him for being a witness to that, for realizing that she wasn't perfect after all. As the months passed, Sarah began to remember how flat the world could seem, how boring it was when the realities of everyday life crept in, and hiding away underneath the duvet for hours no longer seemed like a viable option. Oisin, can you just grow up? Oisin, is it so hard to put your dirty dishes in the laundry basket? Oisin, did you have to get so drunk last night? I was mortified by you. It was like a vicious fever rising in her, urging her to lash out at him, to draw blood. Sarah couldn't seem to control it.
"Why are you being so horrible to me?"
Oisin had asked when she said he was so thin that it felt like being fucked by a 12-year-old boy. He left then, coming home that night with whiskey scorched onto his breath.
"I don't know what I did wrong, Sarah,"
he said, before passing out on the bed beside her.
"I'm sorry,"
Sarah whispered,
"but you were supposed to make me happy forever, and I'm not. I'm not happy anymore."
Sarah could never quite forgive Oisin for that. Then,
"Fionn!"
I banged my fist on the door again.
"Fionn, come on!"
He turned the radio up. Mariah Carey's warbling, "All I Want for Christmas Is You."
"Fine,"
I said, raising my voice so he could hear me. "Be like that." Downstairs, Robbie was stirring a pot of porridge on the hob, Aaron reading a fashion magazine with a pen in hand, circling items he wanted to show to his buyer.
"Fionn's door is locked,"
I said, slumping in a chair.
"When have any of us ever locked our doors? This is getting ridiculous."
"Maybe he's afraid you'll nick one of his paintings,"
Aaron said.
"Excuse me?"
"Can't believe how selfish you are sometimes, Sarah."
He shook his head.
"It was a big deal for Fionn to give you that piece, and you just hand it over to some random dude."
"Who told you about that?"
I said.
"I finally got it out of Fionn last night. I couldn't figure out why he hadn't said a word to you for 4 months,"
Aaron said.
"Can't say I blame him. That was cold as fuck, Sarah."
"Oh, shut up, Aaron,"
I said. "And it's not just some random guy. He hadn't texted in 10 days. I thought giving Matthew the painting would bring us closer together, and it did, for a while.
"We should go on a holiday,"
he had said to me.
"Somewhere where no one will know us."
But then he was busy when I'd tried to set a date, and there were business trips to London and to Washington and Sydney that had to be prioritized, obviously, and
"I couldn't bring you with me, Sarah. You would be far too distracting."
And then Harry needed him this weekend and that weekend, and messages were left unanswered, and dates for room 63 were cancelled.
"It's fine,"
I said every time.
"Don't worry about it."
And I was left waiting and waiting and waiting, morning turning into afternoon, turning into evening, my world shrinking, folding itself around the phone, willing Matthew's name to flash onto the screen. The less he texted, the more I seemed to want him.
"Whatever,"
Aaron said, washing his mug out and turning it upside down on the draining board.
"You know what you did wasn't cool."
I waited until he left.
"Are you fighting with me too?"
I asked Robbie as he placed a bowl of porridge on the table, shaking flaxseed into it.
"Of course not," he said, "although I'm not sure Matthew Brennan is worth all this hassle."
I had told Robbie a few weeks ago, after a bottle of red wine and half a Valium. I knew I wasn't supposed to tell anyone, but I kept letting it slip. Had Matthew told his friends about me? Did he find that my name was at the tip of his tongue every second of every day as well?
"What are you talking about, Rob?
Kevin told you that Matthew was a good guy, that he was the only one in Clongowes who was nice to him, even though he was gay." I had been so proud when I heard that story. I knew Matthew was kind, deep down.
"Oh, Sarah,"
Robbie said. "That was a long time ago, my love."
19th of December.
Sarah.
Brennan. So, listen. Dunfinan calls on Monday.
Matthew.
Okay. What's Dunfinan?
Sarah. It's in Tipperary. It's my hometown.
Sarah. I want to give you your Christmas present. You free this weekend?
Matthew.
I can't this weekend. I have Harry.
Sarah. Ah, I was looking forward to seeing you.
Sarah. Is there any half hour you can spare me? I'm going home on Monday and I'd love to see you before I go back.
Matthew. No can do, I'm afraid. Sarah. I don't think I'm asking for too much. All I want is to see you before going home for Christmas. Come on, dude. Matthew.
Sarah, I don't want to be causing you upset. Just tell me to leave you the hell alone, if this is getting to be too much for you.
Sarah. No, of course not. Sarah. I really am sorry, okay? Just forget I said anything. I'll see you in the new year. I was on Dawson Street, battling through crowds of panicked people doing last-minute Christmas shopping, when I saw him. He was sitting on a long stool by the front window of a cafe, his iPhone pressed to his ear. I pushed the door open and walked in. I should not have been doing this. I was breaking all the rules, his rules, by doing this.
Please, he said to whomever he was talking to. I'm begging you. Please, just give me...
He looked at the screen, then put it back to his ear.
Hello? Hello?
He placed the phone on the table in front of him, rubbing a hand across his jaw. Matthew, I said. He looked up, seemingly unsurprised to see me.
Sarah, he said. How nice. You look fantastic.
Thank you, I said. It's been a while since we've hung out.
Yeah, he said. I'm sorry, I meant to get back to you.
Ah, don't worry. I know the way it goes. He pointed at my shopping bags.
Anything interesting?
I had to pick up something for Fionn's present. I'd bought a book on Wes Anderson and another about feminist artists of the new millennium, neither of which I could afford, but I was hoping it would make him forgive me. I would give him the books and I would tell him I was sorry yet again. Maybe this time he would believe me.
Very good.
That's Fionn McCarthy.
I thought as much.
He cut up a section of his crepe, but he didn't eat it. Speaking of Fionn, how's Harbour Skies doing? I asked.
I haven't been telling it bedtime stories or anything, but I think it's coping okay.
Ha! What did I expect from him? Eternal gratitude? Yes. Did I expect the present would make him realize how much I understood him? Yes. Make him realize we should be together properly? Yes. Okay, I said. I'd better... I gestured towards the counter.
Sit with me.
Oh, I don't want to intrude, I lied.
You won't be.
Are you sure?
Sarah, I'm sure. I'd like the company, honestly.
I thought you had Harry this weekend, I said as I took a seat opposite him, tucking my bags beneath the table.
Yep, he said. So did I.
Jesus. I looked at my phone for the first time since I had met Matthew. It's 11 o'clock. Lunch had turned into coffee, which turned into cocktails. I should go, I said after our second drink, pleasantly light-headed.
No, he said. Please stay out. 'Tis the season and all that.
He said he was starving and we should go for dinner.
Come on, Sarah, it'll be lovely. My treat. Please say yes.
It's the Saturday before Christmas, I argued. There's no way we'll get a table anywhere. Within 10 minutes, we were being seated at Fade Street Social. It's nice to see you again, Mr. Brennan, the hostess said. Was this what life would be like with Matthew? No more queues or waiting, the implicit understanding that I would be welcomed everywhere once I was on his arm.
We'll have a bottle of your finest champagne,
he told the sommelier. And when that was finished, there was wine, and more wine again. At the end of the meal, Matthew paid the bill and walked me outside. I can't believe it's that late, I said.
Time flies when you're having fun, he said.
We were in the doorway of the restaurant, waiting for the rain to stop so we could decide where to go next. It was fun, I agreed.
Although I can't remember the last time I was out with someone who got asked for ID. You're such a baby.
I don't know, I said. I'm old enough for lots of stuff.
Oh, really? He touched his fingers to my stomach, and the promise of what was to come ripped through me. Taxi, he said, hailing down a passing car. His hand on my knee in the back seat, inching up my thigh. He was watching me closely, too closely, as if he was trying to learn my face off by heart. It felt so intimate that I had to turn away from him.
Just here,
Matthew said to the driver, leaning out the window to key in the code to the iron gates. The taxi made its way up the tree-lined drive, gravel crunching, until the house came into view. It was enormous, the biggest house I had ever seen in real life, and seemed to have been carved out of glass and stone, clinging on to the cliff edge over the sea.
Jesus, this your place?
The driver asked with a whistle. Matthew didn't reply, handing him a 50-euro note and telling him to keep the change.
Happy Christmas, he said.
Your house is beautiful, I said as he turned the alarm off, trying to sound nonchalant, as if I had been in dozens of houses like this and was accustomed to such wealth.
It keeps the rain off,
he replied, leading me into the kitchen, metal and glass gleaming, light bouncing off hard surfaces. Big house for one person, I said, the wine making me brave. Do you ever get lonely all by yourself?
I'm never here,
he said, opening the fridge to grab a bottle of water.
And I have Harry every second weekend, so...
There was a photo stuck to the fridge door with a tacky Eiffel Tower magnet. In it, Matthew looked happy, his head thrown back with laughter, one hand on Harry's shoulder, the other around Florence's waist. The perfect family.
Whoa,
he said as I backed him against the countertop, kissing him. I dropped to my knees, unbuckling his belt. He grabbed my wrist and I looked up in surprise. What's wrong?
Nothing, he said, but I don't want to do that right now.
What? Why not?
I just... He broke off. I've had a little too much to drink. I don't think I'm going to be able to...
Oh. I said, is there anything I can do to,
help things along?
He pulled me to standing.
Happens with men my age, I'm afraid.
I tried to look as if I understood.
I just want you to sit with me for a while, Sarah, he said. Please.
The living room had a plush velvet sofa, an antique grandfather clock, and a 10-foot Christmas tree. Stacks of beautifully wrapped presents beneath it. After lighting the already set fire, Matthew claimed the couch, while I knelt by the fireplace, smiling nervously. Matthew wanted me to play a new role tonight, but he hadn't given me the script. He just expected me to know what to say and how I should behave.
Here, he said, have some of this Merlot. It's an excellent vintage.
And I drank it carefully, trying not to stain my lips or my teeth in front of him. The clock chimed midnight, and we talked about art mainly, but about books too, and music. He asked me what I was currently working on, frowning when I told him I was taking a break.
You're an artist, he said. You can't take a break from that. It's part of who you are.
I closed my eyes, breathing the words in. Maybe I would be an artist, if I was with him. Fuck, I said as I spilled wine on the carpet. Fuck, I'm so sorry.
Taxi for one, please.
Oh, shut up, Brennan, you're as drunk as I am.
You know, I think I might be.
He took the glass from me and placed it on the coffee table. I'll get a cloth from the kitchen.
Don't bother, he said. The housekeeper is here every morning.
Even on a Sunday?
Every morning. She'll take care of it tomorrow.
But it's red wine. That'll stain.
I said, don't worry about it.
He pulled me closer to him until I was sitting between his legs, my back against the couch. He leaned down, resting his chin on top of my head, and I felt as if he was putting us into position, readying our pose for a portrait painting. A replication of The Lovers by Magritte, perhaps. We would turn to kiss, grey hoods covering our faces and our mouths, the fabric coarse against our searching tongues.
never quite able to find our way to connect with one another, no matter how hard we tried.
You know when you asked me earlier if I was lonely, he said.
Yes? He stayed silent, the grandfather clock chiming 1 a.m.
I was supposed to have Harry this weekend,
he said eventually.
Did I tell you that?
You mentioned something in your text the other day.
I was supposed to have him this weekend, but Flo...
He stopped.
Well, Flo had other ideas, didn't she? She always has ideas for Harry that don't include me.
I didn't know what he wanted me to say.
It's hard this time of year,
he continued.
This big house and that stupid goddamn tree. I keep buying him more presents, you know? As if that will make things better. This isn't what I wanted for Harry. I wanted things to be different. I wanted...
He leaned back against the sofa.
I didn't want to end up like him.
Christmas can be a tough time for everyone, I said. No point in letting it get to you. I reached for the bottle. This will help. I poured some more into his glass. Come on, Brennan. Don't let the side down.
No, he said. I've had enough. I'm going to bed.
Bed?
Yeah. Do you want to go to sleep?
The two of us lying in his bed, my head tucked under his armpit. He wouldn't want to have sex with me, he would want to talk. Harry and Florence, his dead mother, and fathers that are so easy to disagree with. Matthew's arm tightening around my neck until I couldn't breathe. He would expect me to listen to him, to soothe him, and to tell him everything would be okay. Maybe he would expect me to share my secrets in return. You go, I said. I'll be up in a minute. His footsteps on the stairs, slow, tired. I watched the logs burn, blue flames licking at their corners. The clock chimed 2. I'm safe, I thought. He must be asleep by now. I examined the presents under the tree, turning the tags over to read the messages. There was a gift from Harry, a small box from Florence. Love, Flo, kiss, the tag said, and I wished I could see what it contained. His bookshelves were sparse.
I'm not much of a reader, can't see the point in it, to be honest,
he had told me earlier, and there were only a handful of books, hefty tomes on art and culture, the odd memoir of a successful businessman. A few novels, Hemingway, Thomas Pynchon, Philip Roth. There was no television, no DVDs or box sets. He found all that nonsense to be a waste of time. There were framed photos on the walls, a few faded pictures of a woman I guessed was Matthew's mother, the rest mostly of Harry. Harry on his first day of school. Harry smiling gap-toothed at the camera. Harry and Matthew sitting side by side on a sofa in a different house to this one, both asleep, heads drooping to the side. I moved through the rooms as if I was scavenging for clues, something that finally would reveal the truth of Matthew to me, something I could use to make him mine at last. The downstairs bathroom, L'Occitane hand wash, Egyptian cotton towels. Quilted toilet paper with folded tips, like you saw in hotels. A spare deodorant and toothbrush in the cabinet. The kitchen, coffee capsules and wine glasses in the cupboard. The fridge full of stacked containers with days of the week written on them. Caveman Cuisine was the company that provided them, the labels listing the number of calories, macros, and the amount of protein in each meal. In the hall, an intricate chandelier was dripping diamond light onto a mosaic-tiled floor. Another room. A study. A framed photo of a baby Harry in a Santa hat on the desk, a Mac computer, filing cabinets. I sat in the desk chair, twirling around until I was dizzy. Then I opened the drawers one by one. Nothing out of place. Everything was so tidy and well organized. A fountain pen, a leather-bound notebook, an iPad, a stress ball. Then I opened the last one, bottom left. Photographs. Matthew and Florence on their wedding day, Florence wearing a cream slip dress, her beauty having no need for embellishment. Florence pregnant, swollen belly huge in a bikini, lying on the deck of a yacht. Matthew and Florence kissing, the camera close on their faces. Matthew holding a newly born Harry, his eyes bright with unshed tears. There was a cigar box hidden underneath the photographs. It was beautiful, ornately carved out of dark wood, with a mother-of-pearl fastening. An antique, I thought. I flipped it open. Sheets of thin paper, spider handwriting scrawled across the page. A crinkling noise as I unfolded it, and I looked at the door in panic, as if Matthew might have heard me from upstairs. "Please, Florence," the letter began. It was dated a few days previously, and was only half finished. "I know that I've made mistakes. I know that I shut you out when we were together, and I never really talked to you about my feelings. But it can't be too late for us. There has to still be a chance for us to be a real family with Harry again. I love you, Flo. I love you more than I have ever loved anyone, more than I ever thought was possible. You have to understand, with my history, with my father the way he was, that it's not..."
"No,"
I said. I folded the letter back up and placed it back in the box, shutting the drawer. I walked out of the study, closing the door behind me. I left before Matthew could wake up.
"Sarah! Sarah! Sarah!
What, Dad?"
I turned off the shower and shouted downstairs.
"I'm trying to wash my hair!"
"Mass is at 12. Would you be ready in time?"
"I'd be ready a lot quicker if you let me finish washing my hair."
I turned the water back on, his voice muffled in the background.
"That was a fierce long shower you had,"
he said when I walked into the kitchen.
"Happy Christmas to you too."
"It was lucky I had my shower before you, or there would be no hot water left. Did you turn the immersion off like a good girl?"
"Yes, Dad."
I filled a pint glass with water, dropping Barocca, Dioralite and Sulpidine into it. "And it took me ages to wash the conditioner out of my hair. The pressure is so bad. Why do you still refuse to get a new shower?"
"I'm so sorry," he said. "Here's the number for the ISPCC. I'm sure they'll have something to say about my shocking negligence."
"I'm not in the mood, Dad," I said.
"Ah, Sarah, will you have a sense of humour?"
he said.
"Man, let's go."
It was cold outside, my breath smoking before me, the car seat like ice beneath my legs. The radio came on, Sinead O'Connor singing Silent Night, my mother's favourite carol.
"Maybe we'll just,
my father said as he switched off the music. We didn't talk for the rest of the journey. It felt as if everyone in Dunfinan was at the church, dressed in smart winter coats and suede gloves. There were kisses on cheeks. "Happy Christmas to you too," bending down to ask small children what Santa brought them.
"Oh, you must have been very good to get all of that."
I followed Dad up the aisle, genuflecting half-heartedly. The altar was dripping in candles and ivy, a nativity scene assembled to the left-hand side. I felt faint, grabbing at the pew in front of me. I shouldn't have gone out last night, but after 2 hours sitting in the parlour with my father, watching Die Hard and eating Quality Street, I had texted Aisling and pleaded with her to come meet me for a drink. "Matthew."
"Hey, where are you? I woke up and there was no sign of you."
"Matthew."
"Presume you got home safely."
"Matthew."
"I hope you're okay."
"Matthew."
"Sarah, I would appreciate it if you let me know you got home all right."
I walked up Main Street of Dunfinan, the wind cutting through me. Aisling was in front of Donny's, waiting for me.
"Kira couldn't come," she said. "Holly's too small and you know she's breastfeeding."
I didn't know that. I hadn't seen or spoken to Kira since the wedding.
"Will we go on rounds?"
I asked Aisling when we were inside, and she pulled a face.
"I don't want to be hung over on Christmas Day.
she said. I have to help Mam with the dinner, and... I blew a kiss at her, ordering 2 vodka and Diet Cokes at the bar.
Just the one, I said.
Your turn, I said. My turn, I said. Your turn, I said. My turn, I said. Your turn, I said. My turn. I can't, Sarah, Aisling protested. I'd be dying tomorrow. I called her a lightweight and ordered a double vodka. Moving through the bar, waves and hugs and, Hi, hi, how are you? What are you doing now? I haven't seen you since last year. Are you still in Dublin? Are you still in London? Are you still in Boston? Are you still in Brisbane? How are things with Matthew Brennan? Aisling asked me when we'd found a corner to hide in. I don't want to talk about it.
Why not?
I don't know, I said. I think I'm over it.
Okay, what went wrong this time?
Nothing went wrong, I said. It's just that I went back to his house a few days ago and he was a bit...
A bit what?
A bit needy, maybe? I said. He's 44. Isn't he supposed to be over all that by now?
Typical Sarah Fitzpatrick, Aisling laughed. Bail at the first sign of reality. Another man's heart shattered.
Oh, whatever, I said. It'll be grand. Enough about that. I'm being a real Mayfainer tonight. How's life with you?
Fine,
she answered, but she said she was tired then, and she called a cab to go home. I had another drink and found Tig Carey in the smoking area, wearing a battered leather jacket and too much hair gel.
Are you going out in town for Stevens?
He asked. And where would I be going? Did I want to meet up for a drink?
Sarah,
he said.
Sarah, you look so beautiful.
I didn't want to remember what happened after that. Sarah.
Brennan, sorry for the lack of contact. I've been having some issues with my phone, and I only saw your texts now. Happy Christmas Eve. Or happy Christmas. It's past midnight, isn't it? I am drunk AF. Ring me tomorrow, okay? Kiss, 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 kiss.
Sarah.
My father muttered.
Put that phone away this minute, you hear me?
Calm down, no one cares. No one was going to notice my phone when it was the children's mass, toddlers and preschool kids scrambling across the altar, while the Monsignor pretended he didn't mind.
So important that they understand the true meaning of Christmas, he said. It's not just about Santa and presents, you know.
He looked relieved when it was over.
You may go in peace to love and serve the Lord.
Outside, my father found his friends, slapping them on the back, asking if they'd make the point-to-point tomorrow.
A year above and beyond is tipped to win, he said. Could be a handy little number there, I'm telling you.
Ash! I called when I saw her, blonde hair scraped into a high ponytail, her face grey beneath her makeup. I hugged her parents and her older brother, Barry.
Happy Christmas, Sarah, her mother said to me. That's a beautiful coat you have on you.
Thanks, Liz.
Liz? Sean?
My father shook hands with them.
Happy Christmas to you both.
He nodded at Barry, then turned to Aisling.
You're looking a bit delicate today, young lady, he said. She should do, by the sounds of how much vodka you two put away last night,
Barry said.
You're a bad influence, Fitzpatrick.
Oh, yeah, I was pouring the shots down her throat, I said.
Totally my fault. We had better get going,
my father said.
Have a good day, folks.
I gave Aisling another hug. Text me later, yeah? I said to her as Dad and I left the church car park.
You couldn't have taken it easy. On Christmas Eve, of all nights,
he said, rattling his car keys.
How much did you have to drink last night?
The normal amount.
What's the normal amount?
The normal amount that normal people of my age drink, okay, Dad?
Drinking to excess is no joking matter, he said.
You should know, I felt like replying.
That poor girl has been going through enough. I doubt she needed to drink herself into a stupor on top of everything else.
What do you mean? Aisling's grand.
Well,
Maybe you think breaking up with your boyfriend of 7 years is grand, but...
What? What about Aisling and Jamesy?
They broke up last month. She moved out of the apartment they were renting in Clonmel and she's back at home with her parents.
I waited until he'd unlocked the jeep door. And how exactly do you know all of this?
Sean told me when I bumped into him at the post office last week. Himself and Liz are devastated. They consider Jamesy to be a part of the family.
He put the jeep into reverse.
Did you not know?
Of course I knew, I said. Don't be stupid. I wondered what my father would say if I told him that I dreamt about the journey home sometimes, floating in that pause between consciousness and oblivion, trying to push myself up through the sticky film of sleep. The narrow street of Dunfinan, faded houses, dirt gathering where the paint was peeling from the walls. The sharp turn away from the town into the country. Patchwork fields and open spaces. The fields were always empty in my dreams, brimming with stillness. It was always so quiet. So very quiet. The tires squealing over the cattle grit. The outhouse thrown up with grey concrete and a corrugated roof. The abandoned washing machine. The ghost of laundry past. My father had said he would get rid of it.
I'll do it next weekend, I promise.
But he never did. The house key under a filthy flower pot. A cat with matted fur slipping through my legs. A swish of a ginger tail against my shins. I always woke up before I could open the door. Sweating, aching for something that I could not name. Back at home, I sat in Nana's old rocking chair while my father set the fire, the same way he always did it. The foundation of fire lighters and briquettes, 3 lumps of coal, and 6 small sticks on top. In the kitchen, he washed his hands in the sink, like he used to do every Sunday before Mass when I was a child, dunking his face in a plastic basin full of hot water, scrubbing himself dry in front of the broken piece of mirror propped up against the kitchen window.
"Should we open our presents?"
he asked me.
"I wanted to wait until you woke up this morning, but then you..."
"I get it. I woke up late. I've ruined Christmas morning. I am the worst daughter ever."
"I was going to say that we didn't have time to do it before we went to Mass. There's no need to be so dramatic."
The Christmas tree was in the hall, tucked under the staircase. It was small, the green branches sprayed with white in an approximation of snow, a cheap thing that Nana Kathleen picked up after she moved in with us. My mother used to say it wasn't Christmas without the smell of fir in the house. We would drive to Clonmel on the 8th of December to pick one out together. "Just us girls," she would say, and I knew that it was us against my father. The December after she died, there was no tree, real or otherwise. I woke up that Christmas morning and ran downstairs to the living room. My stocking was draped over the rocking chair where I had left it the previous night, but it was empty. It had never been empty on Christmas morning before. My father was still in bed. I went in to wake him, the room tight with stale breath, and I put a hand on his bare back, slick with sweat.
"Dad,"
I said, but he didn't move.
"Dad, there are no presents."
"Go away, Sarah," he said.
"But Dad," I insisted, "it's Christmas and..."
"Would you just stop?" he said. "What do you want from me? You're too old for Santa. Just cop on and leave me in peace."
I sat in front of the television for the rest of the day, eating the selection box that our neighbour had given me.
"Poor child,"
she'd said to her friends over my head, as if I was deaf.
"Surely there be no Christmas in that house this year, will there?"
"What did you get?"
the girls had asked on our first day back in school after the holidays.
"What?
Do you still believe in Santa or something?"
I said, laughing at their hasty denials.
"Cop on, will you?"
"From Aisling,"
Dad said now, as he crouched down next to the tree, peering at the gift tags. He handed me a book wrapped in red paper.
"Thanks."
One present from Aisling, a joke gift from my work, Chris Kindle.
Presents for both me and Dad from my uncles and aunts.